This is Jerry Wilmot bringing you London Column. London Column, which brings you items especially chosen for your interest and entertainment in the worldwide service of the BBC. In this edition of London Column, BBC observer Valentine Selsey comments on the recent statement by the Chancellor of the Exchequer on Britain's import programme for the coming year. We take you to Piccadilly Circus, where Winfred Vaughan Thomas tells you how London greeted the return of the statue of Eros, and Colin Wills brings one of the Piccadilly Flower Girls to the microphone. Then on to 36 Craven Street off the Strand to hear Mrs. Lewis Douglas, wife of your ambassador to Britain, speaking at the opening of Benjamin Franklin House. Finally, Stephen Grenfell, who was down in Craven Street on the day, interviews American delegates at this function. As you know, at the beginning of each of our London Column programs, we do our best to try to bring you listeners in America a brief account of the mood of the people in this country. However, this week, it isn't at all easy. We've just heard about the outcome of the Paris conference. Our Chancellor of the Exchequer has told us that the economic situation of the country is still grave, and more important, that the period of restrictions ahead of us has no visible end. And we've been told that there's tuppence a week off the meat ration. Well, as a nation, we're naturally subdued by these pronouncements, not least by the news about our import program for the coming year. Our observer, Valentine Selsey, was in the House of Commons at the time, and this is how he commented on the news.
In short, the Chancellor told us that we're going to import less tobacco, less petrol, less newsprint. We're going back to four-page newspapers, and in due course, fewer films. The reason being that our dollar assets under the American loan are being rapidly exhausted, owing to the abnormal rise in world prices. Food isn't affected yet. Mr. Dalton told the House that present food imports would be maintained, even if this meant spending more dollars than in the past. You couldn't expect increased production on empty bellies. But he added a warning that it might still be necessary to reduce rations of foods. Imports of machinery needed to re-equip the industries of post-war Britain would be maintained at present levels. And raw materials, too, would come high on the priority list. But that wasn't all. The export of textiles would be stepped up because British textiles had the readiest of markets in hard currency countries, and this would mean a greater influx of badly needed dollars. Mr. Dalton hoped that this wouldn't mean increased hardship for the people of Britain. A hardship at home could be avoided, he said, by greater output in the textile industry. Mr. Eden, speaking for the opposition, thought that the Chancellor hadn't underlined sufficiently the gravity of the situation. And anyway, why weren't there any figures? The House and the country must be told exactly what the situation was and why the government had decided to take these drastic measures. Then followed a short impromptu debate with MPs jumping up all over the House to press individual points of view. But generally speaking, there wasn't much controversy. Finally, Mr. Dalton satisfied Mr. Eden by promising detailed figures for this week and a debate for next. The House then passed to other business.
Yes, we've got plenty to worry about, but somehow the fact that our worries are economic rather than political makes our mood subdued rather than dismayed. If you'd gone along the Thames Embankment the other Saturday night, you'd have seen the light in Big Ben's tower, which means that the House was sitting for an all-night session. If you'd walked from Westminster up Whitehall, through the Haymarket to Piccadilly Circus, you'd have found crowds of Londoners quite oblivious of things like import programs, for Eros, shining little god of love, had come back to his rightful place in the center of the circus, which to Londoners is the center of the world. Here's Winfred Vaughan Thomas to tell you all about it.
Promptly at 2:30 this afternoon, he drove up in a lorry, Eros, by the way, wrapped very discreetly in sackcloth, and it lorry did a quick circuit of Piccadilly. Round it went past the big department stores on the corner, from which we're looking down, on the thousands upon thousands of Londoners who've gathered now to form here at this special reception committee, and then a rather distressing thing. No sooner has Eros arrived than down came the rain. It's raining now, but that hasn't damped anybody's enthusiasm. And poor old Eros has arrived, too, to the accompaniment of celestial thunder. Well, a god deuce to that, he's brought his own thunder with him. But no sooner did the lorry drive in, it dodged the traffic, it pulled into the little island right in the center of Piccadilly, and then down came the workmen, the movie cameras chasing them, dodged the buses, the workmen arrived, and quite lightly, and with very little to you from me. In fact, Eros escaped the indignity suffered by Charles I when he returned to Whitehall with the accompaniment of slight whistles of clap hands, here comes Charlie. Well, Eros was hoisted up onto its pedestal, and Eros didn't take very long because it's not very heavy. It's made of aluminium. It's the first statue to be made of aluminium in this country. And it just took about half an hour to fasten him down, and there he is now, poised once again above London town. And I bet it's the very first time that the god of love has been escorted in triumph through the streets of London with the stalwart constabulary, the Metropolitan Police holding up the traffic, and the LCC and the Mayor of Westminster assemble underneath him to give him their blessing.
Later, Colin Wills went down to see Eros. He asked one of the oldest flower girls to leave her roses and violets for a minute to come across and talk to you.
To the microphone now, somebody who has seen Eros up there for the past 50 years. This is one of the flower girls, one of the original flower girls who sat at the base of the Eros statue for the past 50 years. Her name is Mrs. Emma Baker, and she's going to tell you what she feels about seeing the statue of Eros back there in the middle of Piccadilly. Here you are, Mrs. Baker. You tell them how it feels to you.
Well, when I stood at the front of the statue today with my basket, it was the most beautiful time of my life. I sat there, although it was pouring heavens out of rain, and I got soaked. I didn't mind a bit. And although the crowds were all around us, not one ever faltered to go away, all through that long time. And I never felt more happier than today when I saw Eros put back in his little place.
And now from Piccadilly, we take you back down the Haymarket, along the Strand, past Charing Cross Station, and we dive right down a narrow street which leads to the Thames. Here at 36 Craven Street, we take you to a pleasant Georgian house, differing only from the other houses in the street because it has two medium-sized flags, probably better known than any other flags in the world, flying above its doorway. To this house, headquarters of the British Society for International Understanding, came many of the kind of people whom Benjamin Franklin himself would have wished to entertain were he living now. Guest of honor was naturally your ambassador's wife, Mrs. Lewis Douglas, who formally declared Benjamin Franklin House open.
There's something very appropriate in the dedication of Benjamin Franklin's London House as the home of the Society for International Understanding. It would be hard to point to a more international figure than Benjamin Franklin. When he arrived here in 1757, he was a great American. While he lived here, he became an eminent British subject. He was a member of the Royal Society. He was given honorary degrees by Edinburgh and by Oxford. He thought of himself as both an American as an Englishman. His biographers tell us that his first 5 years in this house were perhaps the happiest of his life. But Benjamin Franklin was more than a citizen of two countries. He was a citizen of the world. It was while he lived here in London, off and on, in the stormy years, beginning in 1757, that he emerged as a figure of international renown. Here, growing into a sage, he prepared for the great final labors of his life in America and in France. It is Benjamin Franklin, the world citizen, that we salute today, who lived in a period of collision and war, but he always loved peace. He always stood for union and harmony, and he became one of the great representatives of international culture. May his spirit bless the purpose of this international society as we unveil his tablet.
Our man on the spot was on the spot. First of all, he talked to Commander J. Bennett Nolan, one of the visiting delegates who represented the Franklin Institute of Pennsylvania. Commander Bennett Nolan began by giving his impressions of the opening ceremony.
This house is one of the great shrines of London, one of the most historic shrines, and also the shrine with the most meaning because it really is the epitome of international understanding and accord. It is so because it is the home of the first great Anglo-American Benjamin Franklin, who was really an inhabitant of both worlds. We must always remember that of the last 30 years of Benjamin Franklin's active life, from 1757 when he came to England to 1785 when he went home to die in 1790, less than two were spent in America. He was first in England, the trip to Scotland, Ireland, France, and Holland, and latterly in France. So much does he belong to the Eastern Hemisphere rather than to the Western.
Now, sir, I'm going to ask you one last question, which I hope won't stymie you, but you talked of Benjamin Franklin as the first of the great Anglo-Americans. Now, if he were alive today, old Ben Franklin, if he'd been here, and if he'd seen this, and if he'd seen the world and the state of things, what do you think he would have thought?
The aphorisms of Ben Franklin were never so appropriate. You remember that he wrote under the title of Poor Richard.
Yeah.
One thing he said there was, keep thy shop, and thy shop will keep thee. What more appropriate when the Economic Congress is meeting at this moment in Paris? And when we are told that we should disarm again and abandon all armed restraints, I always remember what he said, when the well's dry, we know the wealth of water. The weight of water. A very good thing to remember. But I think perhaps the most appropriate aphorism is the one which I heard your ambassador, Lord Inwood Chapel, enunciate in Washington only a few weeks ago. We must all hang together or we'll hang separately.
Next, our man on the spot talked to Andrew Milne, one of the 12 honorary members of the famous Poor Richard Club in Philadelphia.
What do you think of the idea behind it all, which is essential?
I think it's a grand idea. Honestly, I think it's magnificent. The work that this society is doing, we should know more about it, I think, for one book. I think the fact that in the last half an hour here in this opening of this resort building, we've had really a great trip. For anybody who's been to America, especially Philadelphia, and any Philadelphian or American who's been to this country, and many millions have been, I think it's a real thrill, and I've been most excited with the great spirit which has existed here with very important people.
My feeling has always been that it was easy enough to sort of cooperate in Anglo-American relations during the war, because after all, we were fighting together.
Yes.
Now the peace is more difficult.
I don't think it's more difficult at all. I think it's easier, very much easier. The Americans understand that, so we understand that. And I am a great believer in that great international understanding, and I think we should develop it for all the world. And anything I can do it, that's why I'm here today.
At the beginning of this program, we talked about the mood of the people of Britain. Subdued? Dismayed? We'll leave you to figure that out for yourselves. And now we send you across the waters of the Atlantic the sound of the bells of one of our oldest churches, the Church of St. Mary the Bow. And their music, this is your narrator, Jerry Wilmot, closing London Calling. This program was written and produced by Peggy Broadhead.